ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
So it just means it's gone. It means there's nothing. It's like the family farm. If you've got a house that you can leave to people to inherit, you know, the normal person, that's gone. It's like someone taking up and just selling it. There is no next generation. There's no next generation for us.
A commercial fishing family in WA says they're losing more than just a business after the WA government announced permanent fishing bans. We'll have more on that story soon. And the world's largest crocodile in captivity until his death last year is going on display in far north Queensland. This comes as more findings are revealed about the cause of death of Cassius the croc that will hopefully improve understanding of ageing in crocodiles and how to better care for them.
Old age care homes for crocodiles don't exist. So, you know, just like any animal, managing older animals is a different space compared to managing a younger animal or a middle-aged animal. So, yeah, it's a steep learning curve, but it's one that we need to embark on to better our practices.
I'm Alex Simon, and this is Australia Wide. But we start in New South Wales, the state with the unfortunate distinction of having the highest road toll in the country. And a warning, this story may be confronting for some listeners, as it does deal with death and road trauma. More than 330 people have died on New South Wales roads so far this year, an increase of more than 8% compared to the same time in 2024. Families who've lost loved ones are pleading with motorists to slow down over the school holidays and are calling for tougher penalties as the road toll continues to rise. Newcastle reporter Ben Clifford spoke with families affected by road trauma in the wake of the latest figures.
I'm Renee. I live at Gilliston Heights and I lost my beloved husband on the 2nd of December 2024 in a tragic car crash. Troy was a very kind and generous human being. He was so loving and affectionate. He was a great dad, a great friend. He was loved by everybody who knew him. He was just a larrikin. Troy went off to work on Monday the 2nd of December 2024 to complete a overnight camping job up at Gunnedah. He was on the train and there was a broken rail, so he was pulled off the train and placed in a crew car to continue the journey. 23 minutes down the road at Marulla on the New England Highway, north of Scone, he was tragically killed in a car crash where a truck veered to the wrong side of the road and collided with Troy's car, and Troy was killed instantly. The impact is that we lost the best bloke ever on that day. To get a phone call from his workmate to say that Troy never made it was the worst day of my life. Having to tell his children that they had lost their father in a tragic road crash was one of the hardest things that I've ever had to do.
We're here to talk about the road toll and the number that's gone up. There's more than 300 in New South Wales already this year. What do you make of those numbers?
The take I have on increasing road tolls is driver behaviour. Everybody seems to be in a hurry and wants to get to their destination. But we need to change those behaviours. We are all responsible for our own actions. And until you lose somebody or know somebody that has been killed in road crime, you don't understand the ripple effect it has on not only the families, but the wider community. So please, when you get behind the wheel of a motor vehicle, slow down, be vigilant, be alert, don't drive tired, don't take drugs, don't drive intoxicated, because no family wants to go through what we're going through.
I'm Chris Mostyn, and I live in Lake Macquarie. I'm Jacob Mostyn's mum, who was killed in a car crash in 2023. Jacob was 19. He was an apprentice as a carpenter, and he was just kind of, I suppose, starting his life, really. He was almost at the end of his apprenticeship. He wasn't a kid that liked school. He didn't like TAFE. He was very much an outdoorsy kind of boy. I was actually ready to run out the door with Jacob's younger brother, Ben, and we were going to the dentist for an appointment, and so I had my bag and everything literally on my shoulder, and the phone rang, and it was Jacob's boss, and I did look at the phone and hesitate because I was running a little late, and I answered the phone, and he just said, "Jacob's been involved in a car crash." And I said, "Is he okay?" And he said, "I don't know." And then he said, I asked him again, and I said, is Jacob alive? And he said, "I don't know." So yeah, it was just like the whole world just, I suppose in some ways it just stopped, but also it just exploded. It was very sudden, the impact. It's just, you never think you're going to lose a child. Like, you know, my whole life has been around, you know, my children and raising them to be well-adjusted, kind young men. And to have Jacob just taken away so suddenly, the impact has been huge for me and his siblings. You know, we've all dealt with it in a different way, and you know, it has blown us apart in some ways and then brought us back together, and it's been, yeah, the impact has been massive.
In 2025 so far this year, there's been more than 300 people killed on roads across New South Wales. That figure's up for the same period last year, so it's increasing. How do those kind of numbers make you feel?
I think it's really disturbing, and to know that the majority of those would be unavoidable is, yeah, it's tough. And I think there needs to be, look, more education with young people. They all think they're invincible. I've got, you know, five boys, and they all think they're invincible. And you know, to have this happen to Jacob shows that life is so precious and can be taken away so suddenly. I also think the consequences need to be harsher. The legal system is letting people down.
Data from the New South Wales Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research shows the majority of offenders charged with driving occasioning death over the last 4 years were sentenced to supervised community service. Fewer than 37% were sent to prison, and most of those jailed served less than 2 years behind bars. Renee Ernst says the lack of jail time sends the wrong message.
It's absolutely heart-shattering to know that people that dangerous drive occasioning death in a serious road crime could be still walking the streets. We have to have no Troy here every day of our lives, but they are allowed to stay in the community, potentially sometimes do some community service, and it's not good enough. We're facing another Christmas without our Troy. It's just so hard to believe.
That's our reporter Ben Clifford speaking to Renee Ernst and Christine Mostyn from the New South Wales Hunter region. And if this story has raised some issues, you can contact the Road Trauma Support Group in your state, or Lifeline is available on 13 11 14.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company here on Australia Wide. A commercial fishing family in Augusta says they're losing more than just a business after the WA government announced the permanent shutdown of commercial fishing of demersal species between Kalbarri and Augusta. Jeff and Beverly Cook have been shark fishing for 45 years, working gill nets between Bunbury and Walpole. They had hoped to pass the business on to their sons, but that no longer seems possible. Rachel Boothman has the story.
It's like being in the ocean and drowning and no one's putting an arm up to help you. And that's what it is, and that's what DPIRB is doing to us. They're throwing us in the ocean, put a weight round a leg, dragging us down without having any help.
That's how Augusta fisher Beverly Cook describes the impact on commercial fishers after the state government announced a permanent shutdown of commercial demersal fishing along the west coast from January 1st, 2026.
I was at home here and Jeffrey called me from the fishing boat and said his deckhand Clint had seen something on Facebook about the big changes in the fishing industry, and I just said, "Oh, here we go again." And then about an hour later, I opened up and then found out on Facebook.
After 45 years on the water, Beverly and her husband, Jeff Cook, have built a life around the industry, and they call Augusta home.
Oh, well, we're in shock because we've been blindsided by that decision, and our fishery is as good or better than when I first started. No shortage of our target species. It's just a family business, and a lot of our shark gets consumed here in the southwest. You know, keep the hotels and fish and chip shops, and it's a good product, you know.
Beverly says by the time an email was sent out formally confirming the closure, families had already panicked. And what upset her most was the lack of information about support. The mother of four says the absence of clear mental health support from the government is putting lives at risk.
Even at the meeting in Perth, that I tell her there's no relief funding straight away. So all the deckhands and that and all the workers and any repayments, any fuel bills, we've got insurance coming up, that's just going to affect us straight away. The mental health impact on everyone is nearly suicidal. And it's only when I requested the information from the hotline that when they sent the first letter out with just a copy of what's been in the media, that they put the Stay Afloat health line out. And I've told every single deckie, every single person to ring that Stay Afloat and register it, because we're not going to cope, but a lot of them are too proud. But yeah, very hard.
That notice sent to licence holders directed fishers to the industry mental health service Stay Afloat. But federal funding for Stay Afloat in WA ended in September 2025, just 2 months before the ban was announced. The organisation confirmed its services in WA were paused due to lack of funding. But a spokesperson for the Fisheries Minister insists the helpline numbers still connect callers to support services and say the closure is necessary to protect vulnerable fish stocks.
What went through my mind is that here we go again. To get any fair compensation from DPIRB is going to be another year battle of continuous bookwork. I just think that if Jackie Jarvis come down and talk to fishermen, we could cope with a two-year ban as long as we can foresee some foreseeable future. You know, as long as there's something there, but now it's just this black wall, just cut and dry. We can have 50% reduction again. We can have closures. We can do anything to measure it when we reopen, but they've just given us nothing. So I can't see us going anywhere.
It's hoping that some of the other, me family would take it on. You know, boys, I've got two boys that are doing other things at the moment. We didn't really want to get out of fishing.
So it just means it's gone. It means there's nothing. It's like the family farm. If you've got a house that you can leave to people to inherit, you know, the normal person, that's gone. It's like someone taking up and just selling it.
Do you feel for the next generations that are coming through who might have wanted to do this?
I feel for them because there is no next generation. There's no next generation for us. There's no next generation at all. So they've all gone.
You mentioned earlier about a next chapter. What do you hope that is for you guys?
Well, it's 3 months before they're going to do any compensation. So if 3 months before they're going to put anything out, they're doing 43, whatever it is to get that going. It'll be 12 months before, stated at the minute, the day before you get any money or anything like that. So we've got to struggle through that period. The next chapter is probably trying to sell the Tracy Lee and then maybe get to go on a holiday. You won't go fishing, mate, because you can't fish.
That's Beverly and Jeff Cook. They've been operating under Eagle Bay Fisheries in Augusta for 45 years, and they were speaking with Rachel Boothman. When announcing the ban last week, the WA Fisheries Minister Jackie Jarvis said the bans were to protect the iconic WA demersal fish from extinction, and it was necessary to ensure our kids and grandkids will be able to enjoy fishing into the future. Speaking to the ABC's Richard Hudson, the minister says the industry compensation package is generous.
It was my decision to say that if we buy out these 41 commercial boats, we immediately return 56% of the catch. And we're talking 280 tonnes of fish is actually, you know, not taken next year by doing this commercial cut. They are fish then that become available to our recreation and tourism sector. And I appreciate it is really difficult, but I had a choice between 41 private businesses and 40,000 recreational fishers. This is not like farming. This is wild catch fish that belongs to everyone.
We're hearing a lot of criticism. Licensed buybacks are one thing, but What about the compensation for loss of income for those who have now lost their livelihoods? There's a lot of deckies, there's a lot of people involved in the processing side of things.
Look, I mean, as I said, of these 41 boats, the vast majority of them were fishing 1 or 2 days a week. So they may say there's a lot of deckies. I've asked WAFIC to say to me if they are genuinely concerned that there are people who won't receive a payout from their employer, that they should let me know. There is many, many of these licence holders were only allowed to fish 1 or 2 days a month because of the actual, quote, like the cuts they've had over numerous years. You know, this was described to me as death by a thousand cuts, that, you know, over the years they've had so many cuts. When we did a voluntary buyout in 2023, we were actually oversubscribed in this fishery. So more fishers wanted to voluntarily leave the industry than we had funds allocated. This time we've allocated a significant amount, $20 million. 41 boats are sharing a total gross production of $5 million. We will work through this with the industry. This is a generous buyout.
That's WA Fisheries Minister Jackie Jarvis speaking to Richard Hudson.
ABC Australia Wide.
Time magazine has named the Architects of AI as its Person of the Year for 2025. The magazine says 2025 is the year when the potential of artificial intelligence has roared into view, with no turning back for humanity. There are currently many conversations over how much creative freedom creative people should give AI and whether someone should accept an award for work made with AI assistance. This week, musicians, studio producers, educators, policymakers, copyright experts, First Nations artists, and venue and festival managers gathered on the Gold Coast to nut out the rules of engagement for songs that use artificial intelligence. Co-founder of the GC Music Awards, Sam Morris, explained to our reporter Nicole Dyer how vital it is to balance the creativity of an artist and their right to use AI to enhance their work.
We tried to take emotion out of the conversation and really just look at some of the data that's coming out.
Let's break some of that data
down. Yes, yeah, because it's absolutely fascinating, Nick. There were two studies in particular that we looked at, and one was from APRA AMCOS, APRA being the Australian Performing Rights Association. So obviously a very keen interest from these national bodies around AI and how AI is being used. They surveyed more than 4,000 songwriters, composers and publishers from Australia and New Zealand. So it's the biggest study of its kind in this Asia Pacific region. And they found that 38% of these creators are already using AI tools in their music-related work. 38%. So it's quite a high proportion. The other study we looked at is by an online resource for studio producers. And that study found that 76% are using AI in their work. But what they did, which was different to APRA AMCOS, is they looked at the type of AI that producers are using. And this was really critical, because when you think about music and what makes a song and the human element of creating a song, the most significant element of the song that people create is lyrics and melody. And so what that producer study looked at is how people are using generative AI, so AI that actually creates songs or melody from scratch, and how people are using assistive AI, which is more an administrative and functional mechanical kind of AI.
A drum beat, for example.
That could be it. Or where somebody is like, I really need a harmonica part in this song and I want it to go, and they've got the melody that they've created, or it's in their head, and they just don't have the resources or don't know how to play a harmonica. So one of the key differences is that generative AI is what their skill level is really doing a good job of asking the AI to do something. But there's no musical or creative skill that goes into creating the lyric or the melody that forms the song. Whereas assistive AI is really something that enhances the human workflow. So that might be speeding up production tasks, or it might be fixing audio or some of the other production tools that people use to, you know, smooth out EQ or other elements of the song. So with the way the Grammys are handling AI is kind of similar. They're not using the same language, but they've said where there needs to be significant and meaningful human involvement for a song to win a Grammy or to be considered for a Grammy.
And where are the checks and balances in all of this, Sam Morris? Because it's all very well to say, no, that was all my work.
That's right. Look, already you trust that people. And it's interesting because the Beatles, you know, they released a song last year which was 100% AI generated. It won a Grammy. This is a really fast-moving space. We are a tiny organisation. We don't even have one full-time staff member between us. We have no resources, mostly volunteers. We really have to come up with these strategies really quickly and then be resilient enough to adapt as things change because, you know, it's like the beginning of the tidal wave where you get that big rush. There's a lot more to come, but the impact is being felt right now. So with the Gold Coast Music Awards specifically, we will be asking people, have you used generative AI to develop the lyric and melody? If so, this song is not eligible for the awards. Have you used assistive AI? If so, how? And we're going to do that so we can assess eligibility, but also so that we can collect data and get a little bit of a snapshot for how Gold Coast artists are using AI. The end goal is kind of twofold. One is to really protect human creativity because ultimately, we are not an awards process or event. We are an organisation that wants to support Gold Coast artists. So ultimately, we want to protect that artistry. But we also want to encourage artists to find ways to streamline their practice and to use tools that might allow them to be more creative. And AI might be one of the tools they can use. We don't know.
Any question to creating a category purely for AI-generated
it
songs?
It certainly came up. Look, we don't want to be the first Australian organisation
really?
To do that. We don't.
Why?
We would rather not invest time in promoting AI as a category if we haven't invested time in promoting other things as a category.
That's Sam Morris from the Gold Coast Music Awards speaking to our reporter Nicole Dyer on the challenges posed to the music industry by artificial intelligence. When Karen refugees began arriving in Australia from Southeast Asia 20 years ago, setting up new lives wasn't easy, but a traditional sport has helped them keep a connection to their culture, and they're hoping to attract new players to help Australia take on the world. Anna McGuinness has this report from Bendigo.
The hollow tap of a plastic ball echoes around a stadium. Inside, men in brightly coloured team jerseys are darting around a court on either side of a volleyball net. But this isn't volleyball, it's Sepakta Craw, and players can't use their hands. To the newcomer, it may seem impossible. Players have incredible flexibility, gymnastic and soccer skills. It's a spectacle to watch as the players backflip to kick the ball mid-air, more than a metre off the ground. Among them is Nate Garwa, who learned to play this game in a Thai refugee camp when he was 12.
For hop. For the NG, happy, you know.
30 years later, the sport is still a central part of his life. Mr. Wa is one of an estimated 4,000 Karen people who live in Bendigo. An ethnic group of Southeast Asia, many have fled conflict and persecution in Myanmar and found peace in Australia. Nearly 20 years since the first family settled in Bendigo, Karen is the top language spoken at home in the regional city, behind English. Mr. Wa's teammate, Esu, organised a recent Sepakta Craw tournament in their hometown.
In Australia, because this sport is very new, you know, we want to maintain this traditional sport that we love. We don't get to do that much.
The tournament has drawn about 50 players from across Victoria, mostly from the Karen and Kareni community. The competition is fierce, but the day is also about bringing the community together off court.
So because everyone lives so far away in Australia, it's not like, you know, it's very, very hard to connect sometimes.
Thasu is sidelined with injury, but has travelled from Melbourne to support his team. It's taken nothing away from his love of the sport.
But when I see like people play, yeah, I just like to give a try to play the sport because I love like when people jump. Hit the ball really hard.
The traditional sport is also keeping these players connected to their home while in Australia. Sepakta Craw is hugely popular across Southeast Asia, and it dates back centuries when the ball was made from rattan, cloth or animal hide. While some of these players learned the game before they arrived in Australia, others have taken it up in their new home, like Mr. Su.
It's mean a lot, actually. Personally, I keep active myself, mental health as well, and for my physical health as well. It's mean a lot to me.
Taking the sport to the next level has seen some of these players represent Australia on the world stage. Mr. Wah and Mr. Su donned the green and gold at the World Championships this year in Thailand, bringing home the runner-up trophy in the quad men's event. Their success helped make the trip worthwhile for the competitors, who have to pay their own way to represent Australia in an amateur sport. They hope the dream of playing for Australia will help call in the next generation and, Mr. Su says, ensure the sport thrives.
This sport is so rare in Australia. We just want to maintain it, keep playing while we can and enjoy.
And he's sharing an open invitation to get on board.
I would love to welcome the wider community to join in if they want to. Come say hi.
Anna McGuinness with that report from Bendigo. And finally here on Australia Wide. Until his death last year, Cassius was the world's largest crocodile in captivity, living at a wildlife park on Green Island off Cairns for decades. Now Cassius is back in taxidermied form as part of a new exhibit celebrating his special bond with late owner George Craig. Our reporter Shani Kim has more.
You know, they spent a lot of time together. George spent a lot of time looking after Cassius. Cassius would often get a little bit excited and sometimes rear out of the water towards him, hoping that George would have a big tuna head or a chicken or particularly a pig head. Cassius used to love pig heads.
Cassius was a 5.5-metre saltwater crocodile, but for Tootie Scott, he was more like a family member. His grandfather, George Craig, drove the enormous crocodile from the Northern Territory to far north Queensland in the 1980s and brought him to his wildlife park, Marineland Melanesia, on Green Island off Cairns.
He came over on the Hales Ferry along with a boatload of tourists, I believe. Quite a spectacle. For the next 37 years, he lived here with us.
Weighing around 1.3 tonnes, despite missing a leg, Cassius made it into the Guinness Book of Records as the world's largest crocodile in captivity. But towards the end of last year, 94-year-old George left his island home of half a century to go into residential care on the mainland.
Yeah, he had a moment with Cassius where he said farewell. And right up until that time, Cassius was doing very well. He had just had his annual health check. You know, there's nothing that gave us any signs of him not being well or anything like that. And then it was within a matter of days that he stopped eating.
Within weeks of George leaving the island, Cassius was found dead in his enclosure. George passed away less than 3 weeks later.
Their time together and also the fact that in the end, they actually both left the earth within a matter of days of each other. It's as if their fates were aligned to some degree.
When Cassius died, Tootie scrambled to preserve his remains, and after a 10-month makeover, the crocodile has now returned to the island in taxidermy form after a long journey by road and barge, much like when he first arrived. Cassius was thought to be anywhere between 70 and 120 years old. A post-mortem or necropsy wasn't able to get a more precise reading of age, but Dr. Sally Isberg from the Darwin-based Centre for Crocodile Research, who carried out the exam, says she did discover more about Cassius's life.
So all of the organs looked normal until I got to the lungs, and there was an area there of basically caseous material. So I brought samples back to Darwin for Dr. Kathy Shilton to look at under the microscope. And what she was able to show is that the fibrous casing that had contained this fibrosis for over 40 years had started to break down through old age and allowed the infection to engulf his body.
And that wasn't all they discovered.
This is the most fascinating part. The other notable finding was that his left rib cage was distended compared to his right one. So it was longer than the right-hand side one. And that didn't make sense because normally you would expect the rib cage to be somewhat symmetrical. So what we did was we went back through historical photos of Cassius. It's been really well documented that when he was caught, he was missing his front left limb. So we knew that at some point in his life, he had been in a conflict with another animal. What we didn't know at the time, though, was that the rib cage had also been damaged in that injury. We've sort of had to piece this story together, looking at the infection or where it was, knowing that it had been encased. He hadn't been through any other trauma since he had been caught or in captivity. So therefore, the conclusion is that this happened a long time ago. And it's very well documented that crocodilians can encase an infection. That's what stops their body from succumbing to it. It's just that it's never been documented to have happened for so long. so long.
Dr. Risberg now hopes to publish her findings to add to the understanding of ageing in crocodiles and how to better care for them.
Old age care homes for crocodiles don't exist. So, you know, just like any animal, managing older animals is a different space compared to managing a younger animal or a middle-aged animal. So, yeah, it's a steep learning curve, but it's one that we need to embark on to better our practices.
That's Dr. Sally Isberg speaking to Shani Kim. And that is Australia Wide for this week. A big thank you to Lisa Herbert for production duties. I'm Alex Hyman. Thanks so much for your company. Have a wonderful weekend. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.